The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir, and we'll be talking Labour. But when Ed Miliband began searching for a candidate in the safe Scottish seat of Falkirk, nobody expected a furore that would test the very foundations of the party and its historical link to the trades unions. Irregularities in the selection process, accusations against Unite, the suspension of candidates, and a police investigation. A heady brew. We'll ask, did Ed Miliband get his response right? Can Labour afford to pick a fight with its major donor? And what does it say about the way we finance politics in this country? Also this week, 40 love to the Prime Minister. With politicians basking in the glow of sporting heroism, three cheers for Andy Murray, what is it about our honourable members and sport? Do they gain political advantage, pun intended, or just a freebie? Stay tuned, find out. And joining me for all of this, The Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee, the editor of Labour List Mark Ferguson, and down the line because he likes to be alone to reflect on his thoughts, our all-seeing political sage in Westminster, Michael White. Welcome to all of you.
I do not want any individual to be paying money to the Labour Party in affiliation fees unless they have deliberately chosen to do so. I have a message to the millions of trade union members currently affiliated to the Labour Party. With this change, I invite you to be at the centre of what we do, day in, day out, at local level. Together, let's change our communities and change the country.
Mark, let me start with you. Run us through the background to this case. As I say, it started in Falkirk and it just looked like a little local difficulty, and suddenly it's mushroomed. How did it do that?
I think most people in the Labour Party presumed that this would be, as you say, a little local difficulty that would go away. But with Tom Watson's resignation from the Shadow Cabinet last week...
He was the coordinator
of the general election campaign. I must stress, there's no evidence that he was involved, but his staff member, Carrie Murphy, has since been suspended from the Labour Party along with the local CLP chair. Carrie Murphy was backed by Unite, amongst others, within the selection. There have been allegations that people were signed up against their will. It's further complicated by the fact that there was a report conducted by the Labour Party that has led to all of these actions, and that report is secret. That report has not been released. There are no plans to release that report, and that report also forms the basis of now an ongoing police investigation. So we're all talking about something that's happened, into which there's been a report that is secret, that is being discussed by the police, but besides occasional leaks that always seem to benefit one side or the other in the argument, nobody actually knows what anyone's being accused of.
So after a few days, it's, I think, what Greta Marks described as clear as mud. Polly, was this Ed Miliband's clause four moment? Because we've heard, you know, there's a pretty messy situation he had to sort out. And I think he tried to clear it in one fair swoop and to really reap advantage from it. Do you think he has?
Well, to give him credit, I think he's always said he didn't want a clause four moment. He was not looking for a fight with the unions or some kind of symbolic fight with his party just to show off that he was just as tough as Blair. This one came to him and he really had no alternative. This was such a stinker, too, that when he looked inside and saw what had been going on, the personal relationships involved, the whole thing stank, and he was shocked. It takes quite a lot to shock people who've been in any political party at the top for years, and I think he genuinely was and thought, right, we can't be doing with this. We now have to look again. So it gave him an opportunity, in a sense, but I don't think he was looking for a chance to strut.
But if he wasn't, he could have just gone in and fixed Falkirk, couldn't he?
No, I don't think so. I think this, particularly the way that Len McCluskey responded, was so aggressive, so abrasive. The head of Unite, what he wrote, you know, it was a sort of head-on challenge. And I think at that point, when somebody, particularly when Ed Miliband is accused of being put there by Unite and other unions through the peculiar electoral college system of electing a Labour leader, he had to stand up and show who was in charge here. If Unite backed down very quickly and said, oh, awful mistake, you know, we must clean this up in Falkirk, never again, it might not have happened. But, you know, Len McCluskey is an intemperate fellow.
Let's talk about Len McCluskey. Mike, two ways of looking at this, of course. On the one hand, if Unite says Labour needs to think more about its members and their backgrounds and, you know, broaden its appeal, then he might have a point there. But the accusation against him is that he really just wants to stuff the party with union supporters. Is that too cynical?
Union officials. I don't actually know Len McCuskey personally. From a distance, he always strikes me... Yes, it is. Keep your distance from these rascals. He always strikes me as an interesting and intelligent man. He talks softly, even though he's a Scouser. Like Ed Miliband, he's elected, and therefore he has to say daft things to please the people who elected him. That's one of the tragedies of democratic politics in all parties and all countries, why leaders end up hating their own parties. So... I'm a bit underwhelmed by this row. Unite is trying to muscle some influence up in the Labour Party. It's paranoid that Tony Blair and Progress, the sort of Blairite organ in the Labour Party, are far more influential and important than they were. They seem to have forgotten, these chaps, that no question of accusation about it, the unions, particularly Unite, elected Ed Miliband over his brother David. I don't know why Ed wanted the job. I didn't know on day one, and I still don't. The Tory press says he's a creature of the unions, and he's got to prove that he's not. And he started from way back because of the circumstances in which he was elected, and he was an ally of Gordon Brown, who also was very much nicer towards the unions than Blair. I think all this will go away, but Ed Miliband has got to take the opportunity, never let a crisis go to waste, show he's his own man. He's trying to do this with this dramatic, pretty significant reform proposal for the union-labour relationship and with other things in the last few days. He's got the public spotlight on him. He's got to use it. That's what being a leader's about.
Mark, what about the core issue here about who is active within Labour, where Labour MPs come from? If that is the central point that Unite would say they're trying to have discussed, that is a valid one, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah, there's certainly an issue in the Labour Party and in all parties about the makeup of Parliament. Parliament does not look like the country, and while the Labour Party might have more people who come from conventional working backgrounds, might have more women, might have more ethnic minority MPs, it's still nowhere near where it needs to be in terms of looking like the rest of the country. And that's a Labour Party which is doing, on all of those scores, far better than any of the other major parties.
Yep.
The argument becomes about whether or not the kind of candidates that Unite are trying to back are fulfilling those criteria. Now, my personal view is any group within the Labour Party is absolutely within its rights to back whatever candidates it wants for whatever reasons it wants. And to try and get them elected, and try and get people elected who meet the aims and goals of those organisations. But we have to be careful not to muddle up having a more politically representative Labour Party and having a more demographically representative Labour Party, because not every working class MP is going to have the same views as an organisation like Unite, obviously.
Absolutely. If you go to Unite and say, right, let's look at some of the people who've got real, authentic working class roots who've been important in Labour, you know, Hazel Blears, Alan Milburn, Alan Johnson, none of these are really regarded as to the right of the party. None of them would count as working class, because working class is, in the Unite language and the sort of further left language, is about not only being working class, but being of the left.
Mike, Tony Blair said that Ed Miliband was being very brave and showing leadership. Is that helpful to the Labour leader?
Well, the Labour Party is doing its best to lose the coming election, I guess Tony Blair chipping in won't make much difference either way. It's Labour supporters who throw their hands up in horror at the mention of Tony Blair, and the biggest single problem of the Labour movement as currently configured is that it thinks that Tony Blair is a problem for it. The man who won them three elections, which is a good deal more than anybody else ever did. I know Wilson won 1-4, but only one of those four was won well, before anybody wants to correct me. Blair is all the things he is, for good and bad, but he was certainly an election winner. So when he says Miliband's doing the right thing, Labour ought to be pleased, but of course it won't be. Tough luck. As to representativeness, I constantly feel the need to point out that working class MPs, there are lots of MPs in Parliament who get the point of what the Labour movement's founders were all about, because their fathers were miners and unskilled workers. But we live in a society where clever children of the working class go to university now, the Alan Milburns. Alan Johnson didn't. He left school at 15 and became a postie. He's just written an extremely good book about growing up really poor, and the unions don't like him either.
But a more recent intake doesn't really fit that picture that you paint of, you know, sons of posties and things like that.
Yes,
they're
they
policy wongs, aren't they?
A lot of them have got, well, the Milibands come from a rather exotic background, refugees from Hitler. I think that's permitted. But most of the people are in the labor movement for a reason, which is to do with their own past or their family's past or the experience of their communities. The fact that many of them have been processed through university, it's true of the trade unions as well, of course, complicates matters. But the position of the political classes in all parties face these kind of problems. It's just that the Tory press cynically runs it up the flagpole with the help of the Prime Minister and his cohorts. Can't blame them for that. It's politics. It's the left which falls for this stuff, which I criticise.
Mark, let's talk about the Miliband master plan here, because part of it would say that the union members would have to opt in to pay their subscriptions. How big effect is that going to have on Labour Party funding?
Enormous. Absolutely enormous. The vast majority of people I've been speaking to, both within the party and within the trade unions, believe that the trade unions and Labour Party do not have the organisational capacity, the cultural, political, organisational structures to try and get the vast majority of trade unionists to opt in.
Wouldn't most trade unionists want to opt in?
I don't think that's necessarily as simple as that. The relationship has always been an organisational relationship between a trade union as an organisation and the Labour Party as an organisation. And whilst there is, at some levels, in parts of the Labour Party that work well, that well organised, a good relationship at a local level with trade unionists, a good relationship at a regional level with trade unionists, the vast majority of trade unionists, I don't think, actually know that they are affiliated to the Labour Party. Now, that is either, depending on where you come at on this issue, an argument for the system that Ed Miliband is trying to abolish, or an argument for the system that Ed Miliband is trying to implement. But on the question of how does this compare to Clause 4, this is much bigger than Clause 4. Clause 4 was cosmetic tinkering. It confirmed something that was already happening or had happened within the leadership of the Labour Party and also within the membership. This fundamentally changes the way the Labour Party is run. It will change Labour Party conference, leadership elections, its national executive committee, selections in constituencies. Everything about how the Labour Party runs will change. The big question is, the Labour Party is already massively constrained in terms of its funding. It already has a significant overdraft to the Co-op Bank, who we don't need to say don't have a lot of money kicking around at the moment. And now its most significant form of external funding, through affiliation fees, is going to be significantly reduced in the coming years. How does the Labour Party run general elections, or even the basic administration of a modern political party, without that money?
Paul, if it makes everyone work harder, unions and Labour, isn't that a good thing to get people on board?
I think Labour has taken a huge hit, and I don't think people have understood what Mark's just said, quite how catastrophic its funding is going to be. It will have to do a hell of a lot less, to use that well-worn phrase, more for less, which doesn't on the whole work very well. So he needs to get such credit for having clean hands, for saying, I'm not signing up people without them knowing they're members. I'm not taking people's money when they don't particularly want to join. I only want people who are members who actually wish to join Labour. And that will be relatively few of these, you know, 3.5 million people who are affiliated nominally, and they may accept their union being affiliated, but it's very unlikely very many of them will want to join. Joining political parties is a really weird thing to do these days. Only 1.1% of people belong to them, which is a tragedy. We desperately need people to join political parties right across the spectrum for the health of democracy. Whether he can revive that sense of obligation, you know, if you're vaguely to the left of centre, you should join the Labour Party.
Well,
you
now,
should
right?
pay your subscriptions. It has now become absolutely urgent that people get that message and stop pussyfooting around saying, well, I kind of vote Labour, but they're not good enough for me, so I won't join them. People have got to put their hands in their pockets as individuals and pay up for the Labour Party.
Michael White, at Question Time, Ed Miliband sought to introduce the parallel of the Tories getting lots of money from hedge funds. Is that
Ed
one a runner?
Right. Yeah, you're damn right it ought to be. Of course, the press is less keen on that one. Bankers, Google, Amazon, Starbucks, tax avoiding, UKIP backing, fellow travelling Eurosceptic millionaires who do their best to push and have been pretty successful, a damn sight more successful than Unite in pushing Labour towards the policies they want, regardless of whether or not they represent the national interest. My jaw drops when I hear some of this stuff. Who's done most damage to Britain in the last 5 years, would you say? Bob Diamond of Barclays Bank or Len McCluskey? Don't all shout at once.
Do you think he can sell it to the public, though, as being a way of maybe taking some of the heat off Labour?
Yeah, if you go at it. But Miliband's had a few good moments on this score. He kind of got it about Rupert Murdoch. There's another of those foreign tax-avoiding billionaires. He's been brave and shrewd and gone with public opinion, but and rightly so. But you've got to keep at it, and you've got to be grown up in other areas. It isn't easy. And before we leave the subject, I've just been reading Charles Moore's biography of Margaret Thatcher. One of the interesting revelations among many, don't stay with me, is the way she got selected as the MP for Finchley, candidate for Finchley in 1959. The basis of her entire career would have been destroyed had not the party agent decided that the bloke who actually won, some Tory toff, would get another chance to become an MP, but this brave young woman of 26 with no social background deserved a chance. What did he do? He fiddled the vote. He lost two of the other fellas' votes and gave them to Mrs. Thatcher. He was the Len McCluskey of his day. They all do it.
So we can get more honest results, maybe. One of the other aspects of the Miliband plan is to have American-style primaries, and we'll start that with the selection of a candidate in London. Polly, is that a good idea?
Brilliant for the London mayor, absolutely brilliant, because the London mayor is a sort of peculiar job anyway, which is all about show and personality. And so if you can have a primary, the chances are you will end up selecting somebody who is more electable, more popular.
Ken Livingstone.
Well, I don't know that it would be him, actually. I don't think it would be. I think, who knows who it'll be? I mean, Margaret Hodges thinking of throwing her hat in the ring. Well, after her brilliant displays of, that real passion against tax avoiding and all the rest of it, she might have a chance. But I think there are quite a few people who might be throwing their hat in the ring. And I think it's exactly the right place to start with primaries.
Mark, what do you get from a primary?
Celebrity candidates. Candidates who generally have more personal wealth or institutional backing than the other candidates. It's been very interesting.
That's not good, is it?
Not always.
Well, Miliband
no.
has said he's going to clean up this question for all selections of a level playing field where everybody has the same amount of money they can spend, so millionaires can't go out and buy it.
But for a London primary, even a reasonable spending cap in a primary which could include up to 6 million people, theoretically, is going to have to be incredibly high. I think we may well be saying congratulations, Eddie Izzard, you are Labour's candidate for Mayor of London.
No, he's not going to run this time, apparently.
If I were Eddie Izzard, I'd be revising my opinion in light of the London primary.
Well, I thought that, and so I spoke to someone on Labour about this yesterday, and they tell me that he's thinking of 2020.
I would keep my eye on Eddie Izzard, but I also keep my eye on both Sadiq Khan and Tessa Jowell, both of whom have been pushing internally for a primary, and both of whom I think would be very pleased that people are remembering that they pushed for a primary, because if there's a system that might not benefit conventional politicians, it is the conventional politicians who shout loudest about what a brilliant idea it is who are likely to come best out of it.
Mike White, it's X Factor politics, isn't it?
An element of that, but people who say Tony Benn always comes to mind, it's the issues, not the personalities, disproved that spurious formula by their very existence. Tony Benn was all about his personality. He was also a fourth-generation MP, but let that pass, and a well-to-do one too. Yes, money would be a factor, but personality is always a factor. Polly said London Mayor's a special case. The one person you haven't mentioned in this is Sarah Wollaston, Tory MP for Totnes in Devon. She's important here because she was elected by an open primary. Anybody could vote in the Totnes constituency, well-heeled little constituency on the Channel Coast. And a lot of people did. And they picked the local GP. I suppose that's a form of personality politics. She was well-known locally. But it cost the Tory party £40,000 to get an MP, who's a pretty good MP in my opinion, but is very independent. And because she feels The Tory party didn't put me here. The good people of Totnes did, both in the primary and the general election. And, you know, the Tories haven't rushed to do that again. Too expensive, but also too risky. So we'll see what happens.
But legitimate. If people are seriously worried about the lack of legitimacy, you know, tiny little selectorates choosing who's going to be MPs,
Sarah Wilson is the one person in the Commons
who has an extra authority. The reason she can be so independent is that she knows she has an authority above most of the
others. And a job to go back to.
And a job to go back.
Yeah, I don't believe this legitimacy stuff. I just think voters, we all agonise about it, and that's all fine. But voters recognise the real deal when they see one. And most of them still say, despite the, you know, disaffection from politics, well, they're all a bunch of crooks and a shower, but mine's all right. Yeah, mine's okay. Yeah, fine.
Wollaston is a fascinating case for Labour Party activists, because I think the Labour loyalist in us goes, oh God, that would be a nightmare to have people like that running around saying what they want.
Yes.
But on the other hand, the sense of devilment and the desire for a more interesting politics, which I think, you know, it's not just those of us who work in and around the media in Westminster want it. I think people quite often want it as well. I think having a few people with a little bit of a sense of devilment and a little bit of a sense of who they are and what they stand for and speaking up for their community might be a good thing for Parliament as well.
It's a good point, though. If it costs that much money to get a single candidate that way, and then not many parties can be able to do many of them.
But if you do it well, you barely need to run a general election campaign, because you can say, congratulations, people of Totnes, for example. You've chosen who you want the Tory candidate to be. 27,000 people or whatever have voted in this primary. You have your 27,000 or whatever people who you think are most likely to vote for that party. Just a case of knocking on the door and reminding them to vote.
Ooh, my alarm bells are going off here.
The question is how well it works.
Money, money, money. America, America, America. Primaries can be very tyrannical.
Ed Miliband is obsessed with American politics. Top to bottom. He had a glint in his eye on Tuesday when he said that he wanted to bring primaries in. Now, that does concern me as someone who thinks the West Wingification of British parliamentary politics is a problem. It gives people unrealistic expectations. There's that gloss on American politics, but when you chip it away, it's much more dirty and complicated than our politics.
Yeah.
But there's no question that Ed Miliband is a big fan of American politics.
But he'd keep the money out of it. What makes American politics so toxic is the extent of the pork barrel and the extent of the amount of money you have to raise, even for quite small posts. And, you know, the quid pro quo for this is a really level playing field.
Yeah, Polly's got an important point there about a pork barrel. Well, everybody has a bit of pork barrel. Look at the Humber Bridge, Barbara. But the real question of American politics is paid TV spots. Now, we banned that in Europe, and it's one of the best things in our politics. But if you don't have paid TV spots and money, how do you communicate with voters? Now, I spent last autumn traipsing around the country in a fruitless task trying to interest people in elected police commissioners. And all the candidates complained they wouldn't give us any money to advertise. How do we get in touch with people? A few people showed flares. Other people had the party machine behind them. John Prescott's case, he had the other party machines united against him, so he lost. Well, that's politics too. But it's a real problem. Without money, how do you communicate? Maybe they should have had a free mail shot, and they were denied that by Theresa May to save money. And Polly mentioned the word legitimacy. Some of these police commissioners were elected with a problem and they've still got it.
Well, let's talk a bit more about that heady brew of money and politics, because obviously one of the big stories just before we made this podcast is MPs being recommended for a bumper pay rise. Good timing, huh, Mark?
Not the best. A time of crippling austerity, public sector pay freezes, stagnating wages in the public sector. It's disastrous. I don't understand why we can't just do something relatively simple here and say either the average wage or the minimum wage will be rising at a set level over the next 10 years. Why not peg MPs' salaries to 3 times the average national wage? They will be very well paid, very well remunerated, which for some MPs is a very intensive job, and some evidently because they have other jobs is a part-time job. They'd be very well remunerated for that, but at the same time, they would have to have a hell of a lot more interest in how much ordinary working people are actually earning and doing their level best to make sure that rises.
Polly, if Ed Miliband's right and they can't have outside directorships and consultancies, don't they need a few more bob from the taxpayer?
Well, not at this moment. You can't do it at a time of where real wages, real living standards are falling so fast. You can't go and do that. You just can't. They're being suggested they get 11% in one wallop. You can't do that. So you have to wait. You have to do it gradually. I think they should be. I think Mark's suggestion is a very good one, pegging it to a national average. Or you could peg it to a civil service grade and say they're equivalent to X or to a certain
profession. That's what they used to do. No, that wasn't acceptable.
Why did it go wrong?
Everything goes wrong. And political
well, that's a great world
political view. Political leaders don't worry about their MPs' pay, as Norman Lamont used to say bitterly as a backbencher. It's all right for Margaret to freeze our pay. She's got Dennis. And then they used to say, all right for Tony, he's got Cherie. And it's all right for Dave, he's got Sam Cam, who's got a few Bob there in the background. Impossible to do. And when Polly says 11% all in one go, actually, no, it's 11% in 2016. It's just 3 years away the last time I looked. So you divide 11 by 3, you're already down to 3.5%. It is impossible. It's always impossible. Nobody likes paying MPs extra money. But in the last moral panic about MPs' perks, that was, of course, about expenses, and all prime ministers, including Margaret Thatcher, who was responsible for letting them charge the mortgage to the taxpayer, that they let them take a bit more on expenses, give them allowances. The whole expenses row hinged on the failure to distinguish between allowances and expenses. The prospect now is that IPSA, the standards authority, which monitors police MPs' pay and expenses, has got the power to enforce this pay rise, whatever the rest of us think. In the panic after MPs' expenses 2009, we created IPSA very imperfectly. One of the imperfect things was they can do what they want if they've got the nerve to do it.
Well, Mike, we'll leave you to tell us who ends up in the ducking stool first, but let's leave that there for now. And you can follow more about this, about Labour and the unions and financing, in detail on our website at guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, an audience of more than 17 million people tuned in on Sunday to watch Andy Murray defeat Novak Djokovic in straight sets to win the Wimbledon Championship. You may have heard of that. As Murray was punching the air, the cameras panned to the Royal Box, where viewers saw an applauding David Cameron, and behind him, the SNP's Alex Salmond gamefully waving a Scottish saltire flag. Murray was welcomed as a British hero to Downing Street, and naturally, a Scottish one from Holyrood. Mike, all good fun, but does it matter politically? Why do they do this?
Well, they think they can get a bit of reflected glory, but they also want to be shown to be interested in things that normal people are interested in. Now, tennis is very much a minority sport, but the same thing would have happened in the unlikely event that England won the World Cup last time, or indeed next time, or indeed any time in the foreseeable future. You know, they like to identify with what people are interested in. And of course, in Murray's case, it was a terrific story. Nobody quite believed it would happen, did they? And I certainly didn't, watching it, even though it was straight sets, until that last ball went into the net, 77 years. So you can kind of forgive them a bit for this. The fact that it's a Scots-British thing, of course, is the subtext of all this. I saw an SNP press release this week. They pumped them out the SNP press office like nobody's business. It's the first I've ever seen which wasn't blaming an English politician for something going wrong. It said that Angus Robertson, the SNP parliamentary leader in Westminster, met and was photographed with Andy Murray at a reception at No. 10 Downing Street given by David Cameron. And he waited for him to say that they used cheap wine or the sandwiches were awful, but he didn't. That was it. It was a great moment for the union, but we mustn't make this a political occasion. Murray is smart enough to keep out of all this stuff, and he's quite right. It's about Andy Murray. It's about tennis. It's not really about the union.
Isn't this just another illustration of how sport can bring people together? Mark, when you see the politician sitting in the stands with his suit on, do your spirits rise or sink?
My hearts go out to them because they were sitting in 30-degree heat, 40-degree heat
They'd be criticised if they didn't wear suits. They can't win, these guys.
Absolutely. But I just felt the poor guys. I don't often feel that about Cameron or Alex Salmond. And, you know, I've...
Not able to raise their arms.
Not able to raise their arms. Polite clapping in front of them, presumably guzzling water whenever they know the camera's on them. look, it's better. I'm a sports fan. I think a lot of our politicians are sports fans as well. Fantastic. Let them go and enjoy it. Let them be part of these national occasions. It's a lot less embarrassing than Gordon Brown pretending he knows who the Arctic Monkeys are, or having David Cameron appear in music videos with One Direction.
Polly,
I agree with that. It would be nice to think that authenticity really mattered, and that I've no idea whether Ed Miliband has any interest in sport. It would be nice for him to say, actually, sport doesn't much interest me, but you know, it's kind of political suicide to do that. So you have to pretend to be interested in everything, and inclusive, and everybody's possible hobby and sport is one for you as well. You have to collect them all up.
Doesn't it say something about the state of politics, though, in that politicians worry that the public aren't really interested in them, and so they have to almost chase after the public? They're almost saying, well, what are the public interested in? They're interested in sport. Why don't we graft ourselves?
I think it looks a bit pathetic and a bit desperate, and a bit of dignity might work, but on the other hand, I think it probably wouldn't work, and they're probably stuck with it.
Two really confident political leaders in memory, John Smith and Margaret Thatcher, had the courage not to pretend that they were interested in things they weren't. On the other hand, wildly improbable, Michael Foot, the literary Hampstead gent, was a passionate, lifelong Plymouth Argyle supporter. He went there all the time, even to his great old age. You can't tell with people. Gordon Brown was keen on tennis.
When he was unpopular everywhere else, he was popular in Plymouth, perhaps.
Yeah.
What about the Olympics? Because there was supposed to be a big kind of big bounce for politicians who were involved in that. Now, people talk about Tessa Jowell as being a possible Labour mayoral candidate, mainly on the back of her contribution to the Olympics.
Or Seb Coe for the Tories. Don't rule him out. Well, he's shown himself to be a talented administrator.
Yep.
He's taken some of the stench of failure away from the way he was associated with slightly less successful period in Tory party history. You know, he's a member of the House of Lords, and maybe that makes it a little bit more complicated, but it hasn't stopped people floating the idea of Una King standing again for Labour.
Una King was a very good candidate. I chaired one of her big meetings, and I was really impressed at how good she was. She was underestimated.
How come she lost the seat?
She got trounced by the... Oh, well, how come she lost the seat? What to respect and
she shouldn't have
done. And all that.
She shouldn't have lost
perhaps,
the seat.
Perhaps it was because she just didn't know enough about sport. We're going to have to leave that there for now. Because you can, of course, follow the ball-by-ball coverage of the cricket on our website, where you can also find our new Ashes podcast, guardian.co.uk/sport. But that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Polly Toynbee, to Michael White and Mark Ferguson. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.